Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Modern Mind, the podcast that simply aims to explore the minds that inspire modern society by provoking thought and inspiring change. I'm your host, Fergus Crawley, and welcome to today's episode. Our guest today is Josh Clemente, who is the founder of Levels Health and has a background at SpaceX and Hyperloop. So when you say it's not rocket science, in this case, it very much is. Levels aims to help people make more informed decisions about their nutrition and better understand how they respond to certain foods so that they can improve their performance day to day. We explore how his background at SpaceX set him up for founding the business. We discuss the working culture at SpaceX and Tesla under Elon Musk and what that was like, alongside the problems that Josh is trying to solve with Levels and why he found himself in this line of work in the first place. There are certain limitations with continuous glucose monitors that are worth mentioning, and I picked Josh's brains on his opinions on these and what the future looks like for CGMs. This conversation covers a whole load of topics, and I'm confident that you will enjoy it. We dive into some things you might not expect. We dive into some things that are maybe a little bit more obvious, but ultimately it was fantastic to sit down with Josh and have this conversation, so I very much hope that you enjoy it. And if you do, please make sure to hit follow or subscribe. Make sure that you've signed up to the emailing list through the show notes down below. Rate and review the show on whatever platform you're listening on, and please share this episode or an episode previously with a friend, as it is the most effective way for the show to grow, probably second to YouTube, where you can go and check us out as well, as we have a big focus on that in 2023. Before we get into the episode, it is important to mention the show's sponsors, as without them, there would be no show. First up, we have Vivo Barefoot, who are the world's leading barefoot shoe manufacturer, and I have been religiously using for just over 3 years at this point. I'm in them 90% of the time, day to day, other than when I'm at a more formal occasion or wearing some dress sneakers to go with a certain outfit, going out for dinner, whatever it might be. But in and out of the office, in and around the house, walking the dogs, in and out of the gym, I'm in a pair of Vivos, plain and simple. I love them. Wide toe box, thin and flexible, means that I can connect with the ground, build my foot strength, build up my ankle joint. And interestingly, in 2021, a study came out of Liverpool University that shows that if you wear Vivos for 6 months, you can improve your foot strength by up to 60%. So my recommendation would be to get a pair to apply to a specific task day to day, get a feel for the brand. If you like the feeling of barefoot shoes, you like the proprioception, you like the wider toe box, you like the feeling of being more connected to the ground that comes with them, then you can explore some more options, but you won't know unless you try. And you can try by saving yourself 10% off with the code FergusVivo at checkout. And do please let me know how you get on over social media. Next up, we have Mancave, who are without a doubt the UK's most exciting men's grooming business, as they are 100% natural, 100% recyclable, 100% cruelty-free, and 100% vegan without any compromising on performance. And they have a huge range of performance-focused products for you to choose from. Everything from weird and wonderful smelling shower gels to shampoo, conditioner, to anti-fatigue eye gel, and everything in between. Your bathroom is covered with Mancave, and mine has been for well over a year now, and I thoroughly enjoy the products. I feel great, I smell great, and dare I say it, sometimes I look great, and that's a nice feeling at the end of the day. So if you'd like to give Mancave products a go, please use the code Fergus40 at checkout to save yourself 40% off, which is an enormous amount of money to save, so do act fast. And please check them out on social media as well as Strava, where they have a thriving community that you can get involved with. So without any further ado, let's dive into today's episode. Josh, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, Fergus. Excited to chat.
Me too. There's a lot to unpack today. And the phrase, it's not rocket science, gets thrown around quite a lot in this day and age. But for you, it in fact was rocket science for the first half of your career, essentially, because you were a rocket science at SpaceX and Hyperloop. So that's a niche. It's a niche job to get into. So do you want to just talk us through how you ended up in that position from an educational point of view, from an aspirational point of view? And yeah, what got you into SpaceX?
Yeah. So, the career aspirations were not SpaceX when I was growing up. I was not particularly good at school. I was not your space camp student, growing up. I was actually homeschooled by my mother. So she was a high school teacher before my parents got married. And then she homeschooled all of us all the way through our K-12 education, right up until university. And even inside of that sort of one-on-one teaching environment, I was not very good as a student. But what I enjoyed doing and kind of relentlessly pursued was building machines that that were fun. So a lot of dirt bikes and four-wheelers and BMX bikes and just kind of constantly outside and building something loud and fast. And So getting to my college university days, mechanical engineering was really the only option for me. It was the only thing that would let me work on vehicles. And I had aspirations actually to work at Tesla Motors when I got out. So the early days of electric vehicles, I had been blown away by what Tesla was building with the Roadster way back then. And it was actually in the process of trying to get an internship at Tesla that the recruiter there said, well, you know, actually Tesla is moving their offices from Michigan to California, to the new plant that they purchased. So we don't have a spot for you, but you should consider applying to SpaceX because, you know, if we would hire you, they might. And that was really it. It was sort of an assumption that I did not have what it took to be in the world of aerospace. And I certainly had never assumed that I would have an option, but what SpaceX was doing differently in the early days is they were scrappy and they were self-funded and they were not a giant, you know, government entity the way essentially most of the other aerospace contenders are. And they were looking for people that built machines, you know, really hands-on generalists, unlike the other companies. So I had an opportunity to sort of just fit the bill back then. I do not think I would get hired at SpaceX today. The bar has moved substantially. So I had it was just a timing thing and kind of an opportunity of a lifetime. So that was the beginning.
So you accidentally became an aerospace engineer. That's not a sentence I think I'll ever say again.
I think that's a very safe way to describe it.
So your main projects whilst you were there were life support systems, weren't they? So do you want to just talk us through what that entailed in terms of the actual mechanical demand, but also what problems were you trying to solve? What were you trying to provide? What was missing? Because ultimately, as you said, SpaceX is a private company, which means mm-hmm. it has more freedom than federal sort of agencies in this space. But with that will come less backlog of information, less database, less systems, less infrastructure, less bailouts, if
historical
needed, potentially,
context,
et cetera.
Yeah,
so
right.
What was the life support system focus for you? And essentially talk us through your time at SpaceX.
Yeah. So actually when I started, I came to the company just after the first booster. So the rocket itself that would carry a payload into orbit, the first one had made orbit. And that was a huge moment for SpaceX, but there was no spacecraft yet. So we didn't have anything. It was just an empty shell that was on top of that rocket. So I was there for the development of the Dragon capsule, which is initially basically just you think of it as a box truck. It's got engines on it. You put a bunch of supplies in it and you send it to the International Space Station, where we have astronauts kind of circulating 365 every day of the year. And that was the first stage of the company, was getting that Dragon capsule from, you know, the computer screen into the real world. I had an opportunity to work in structures engineering and on manufacturing problems. So it was all about like taking designs and learning how to build them rapidly at scale with very high quality. And so, you know, a lot of it was extremely hands-on. We did not have a lot of resources at SpaceX at the time. So I was kind of the guy that would take a drawing and figure out how to build it with the machine shop team, and then take that part and get on an airplane and fly to Florida and bolt that onto, you know, the side of the spacecraft and see it go to space like a few days later. And it was a really amazing closed loop vision. And this is one of the rare opportunities, you know, that you just get. This is why I think startups are so interesting, is when you're at that stage of your career, the learning opportunities are just boundless. And so the Dragon spacecraft was a success. We were able to fulfill some cargo contracts, just an empty box truck, nothing fancy. The next iteration was, well, now we want to take humans, because the space shuttle program had been wound down in 2011. So starting in 2011, the United States had no way of getting their own astronauts into orbit to the International Space Station. We were relying on the Soyuz rocket. And that was a big, you know, a strategic embarrassment and a weak spot in, I think, in the aerospace sector. And so there was this race to be the first to develop a human-rated spacecraft to get us back on our feet. And our goal was to transform the cargo capsule Dragon into a crew-worthy machine. And I had a chance to be one of the first four on that team. And it was really just internal promotion, like who is interested, who has worked on the types of mechanisms. These were like hydraulic and pneumatic systems that would carry different gases through the vehicle. It was really just recruitment. And I had that opportunity to raise my hand, stepped into that role. And that was another phase of SpaceX, because as you can imagine, the risk threshold is substantially different between cargo, you know, empty payload that can crash into the ocean and no one cares, and seven human beings. So the sort of requirements documentation, the relationship with NASA, our customer, was fundamentally changed. And my role there was, I led the sort of high pressure, you can think of it as the high pressure life support systems. And these would be the breathing gases. So you have this box that's in the vacuum of space. There is no atmosphere outside of space, so you can't open the window. You know, you need to carry everything you're going to breathe, everything that you're going to excrete. All of that has to go up and down. So it was about managing the oxygen levels in the capsule, managing the atmospheric pressure. So as you go from sea level to the vacuum of space, the spacecraft has to be very, very tightly sealed to maintain the atmosphere inside of it. And then delivering those gases to the suits, fire suppression. So if a fire breaks out, you know, I led the team that was developing the suppression systems that would detect and extinguish. And there was just a lot of pneumatic systems and a lot of detection and atmospheric control is what I was working towards, and had an amazing team. And that process was, it was sort of a lightning development. We had a very short period of time. And again, like you said, no historical context. This company had never done human spaceflight before. So it was really the Wild West in a sense.
The learning opportunity must be just insane, isn't it? Because it is no blueprint. Well, there is a blueprint, but I'm sure you didn't have access to NASA's blueprint for this. So being given the opportunity to deal with pressure, pun intended, in that setting must have been phenomenal. I think in that setting is, I'd be remiss not to cover this in our current internet-focused climate and question what the actual working culture was like at SpaceX, because obviously under ownership of Elon Musk, there's, whether caricatured, whether fabricated or otherwise, there's a lot of narrative at the moment in terms of what working at Tesla, what working at SpaceX is like. And it seems that if you're not bought in, then you're gone. If you're not a part of the team and you're not willing to sort of jump through hoops, then you're gone, or you're not up to what the standard is expected to be. So is there truth in that, or is it a little bit more nuanced?
So I'll kind of just come out the jump and sort of say, SpaceX, and specifically working with Elon Musk at the helm as chief engineer at SpaceX, was the best opportunity as an engineer I could ever have asked for. There is zero regret and zero sort of hard feelings against the personalities that are present there, because you know, I know that the media coverage is kind of a broad spectrum, and there's a lot of claims that Elon is specifically just the person who can raise money and sort of advertises himself as chief engineer, and that could not be further from the truth. So he is a legitimate technical mind and has built an organization that operates the way it does only because he understands the goals and how to minimize the hurdles to get there. So, you know, when you were saying we didn't have the blueprint from NASA, you know, NASA actually delivered us basically a Bible of requirements. They said, you know, you have to achieve your vehicle must do exactly these things. And it was essentially defining the design before we had the chance to really solve the problem, right? Instead of saying, here's the problem, think of a creative way to solve it, it was saying specifically, here's how you must solve this. And our job really was to take that book of requirements and convert it into the SpaceX ethos, which actually you can find clips of Elon talking about what we call the algorithm. But the first step in the algorithm is delete the requirement or make the requirements less dumb. And you can imagine when you have an organization like NASA, that's really difficult to do. But it's an important philosophy, because to move at that pace and to invent new technologies like a rocket that can flip around and boost itself back through the atmosphere and land on a postage stamp, that playbook hasn't been written, and you have to really minimize the number of what we call mechanical miracles to get there. So what Elon does really exceptionally well is he advocates for that sort of risk-taking, and he doubles down on it repeatedly. So no doubt he's not the one who's designing every piece of the puzzle. He's an exceptional recruiter, so he brings in people who can do that, and then he makes it easy for them to achieve it. So I will just say that first part. Now, the second thing is that Elon kind of refers to people as vectors. So you have a pointing direction. A vector is like pointing in a certain direction. And what he does is he eliminates vectors that aren't pointing in the same direction. That's what he does. He doesn't try to turn you around and try to convert you back to the right direction. He just says, all right, you're not aligned, you're out. And there's tons of pressure there, like to disagree in a way that is very clear that you are open-minded and that you're not steadfast and dogmatic in the way you're believing about the problem is really important. You can't come in and say, that's not possible, or we have to do it this way. You have to come in and say, here's explicitly why I feel the way I feel, and be open to our other opinions. So there are plenty of reasons why people have left the company, and I think they're all certainly valid, but my perspective, I would do it 10 times over.
You were pointed in the right direction whilst you were there, I assume. So was it, a case of if you didn't fit, you didn't fit? Or was there an element of the individual resilience and tolerance for adjustment that made a difference? So I guess the question really is was it an individual responsibility to be able to work through the challenge of the working culture, or were there some people that actually just on paper, great fit, in reality weren't what they were expected to be in terms of the angle of direction?
Plenty of both. Yeah. I think the people who did best there were able to think fast on their feet and find ways to test assumptions even quicker. And so a lot of the really, you know, early on, at least a lot of the standard ways of, you know, sort of building an aerospace program are very analytical, very slow moving, sort of reducing risk to near zero. And the way SpaceX works is, you know, if there's a concern that this component is going to explode, well, put it in a box and blow it up. See where it explodes. Don't spend all day in analysis paralysis at your computer trying to judge with the right mathematical equations what might happen. So it's build, test, iterate fast. And if you can't find that comfort level with moving quicker than might be comfortable, it's really a tough place to be. And so many times I felt that discomfort, and you just sort of have to, you got to lean on the people around you and really take a team approach to it, get peers to look at your approach and gut check you and point you in the right direction if necessary. And there's plenty of that that goes on, and people make mistakes. And for sure, you know, SpaceX has done a lot of publicly visible failing. And some people aren't comfortable with that. They want their work to be perfect, and they want to make sure that it works the first time. And I will say that's not the environment for that mentality.
That's fascinating. It's fascinating because it's not often you get to speak to somebody that's been in amongst the culture that is so often polarized in the media. As you said, the spectrum is broad in terms of this is what it's like, this is what it's like, and then everything in between. So as with most mainstream media these days, it's difficult to know what to believe. But nonetheless, I'm sure that experience has essentially hardened you to a point in terms of the learning, because the 6 years that you spent there must equate to a lifetime of learning in a sort of less fast-paced, less high-risk environment. So the confidence it's given you to move out in the direction that you've now gone, from a business point of view and a personal point of view, I'm sure is very well reinforced. But let's move on to that from a practical point of view, which is what actually led you to founding Levels Health?
Yeah, so it was that experience of the life support program, and two angles on that. So the first is that personally, I've been a fairly fit person my whole life. I'm nowhere near on the athletic status that you are, not even close. But, you know, I take great pride in being physically fit. I've always equated the ability to lift heavy, run fast, jump high to health. And so after playing sports, kind of growing up into university and some club rugby and that sort of thing, I then got into CrossFit as a means of kind of having a competitive nature and also pushing myself physically. So I was doing that, got to sort of a level 2 CrossFit trainer, while just for fun, just so that I would get some of the kinematics and some of the sort of body mechanics stuff down, while I was also working at SpaceX. And SpaceX is a pretty, you know, it's a very competitive, hard environment. So a lot of, you know, I worked basically every weekend for multiple years, and late nights, and often sleep under my desk. So it's very stressful. And I ended up sort of burning the candle in all directions at once, to the point where when I look back, I was at a breaking point physically without recognizing that I had reached that point. And what it felt like was actually that I was a different person. So psychologically, I think my personality and my mental health had changed so slowly, but in such a compounding way, that I was looking at the world differently and feeling differently than I had. And I couldn't remember the last time I felt good or that I felt healthy. And that was in juxtaposition with how I looked, because I looked quite physically fit. I was, again, working out basically every day, low body fat concentration, could lift heavy weight. So that's sort of the backdrop. And then in the foreground is I'm working with this amazing team on the life support program and solving some really interesting technical problems, one of which was the oxygen concentrations in the spacecraft. If a person is subjected to high pressure, high oxygen concentration, oxygen is a very reactive molecule. And what it can actually do is all that very reactive oxygen in the brain can create sort of chaos. You generate a lot of reactive oxygen species, and essentially you can have what's called central nervous system toxicity, which can lead to a seizure and potentially even death. The two environments where this happens most are typically the diving environment, where you're, you know, sort of breathing pressurized oxygen and a regulator fails, or could potentially occur in something like a spacecraft if something goes wrong.
Is the mechanism there essentially the if you're free diving, the controlled descent to acclimatize the pressure, the same as I'm sure in a life support system with oxygen, you are decompressing air at a certain rate rather than, okay, we've changed it. So you need to ease into it so that it's not sudden. Is it that's the mechanism we're referring to essentially?
It's fairly similar in the dynamics, but actually what it is actually the pressure of the oxygen and the overall concentration, the percentage of oxygen you're breathing. So what you don't want to do is be in an environment where you're breathing very high. So as a diver, if you're breathing pure oxygen and you go to a depth where the pressure, the ambient pressure is very high, so the oxygen you're getting delivered to you is extremely dense, tons and tons of high pressure oxygen is being delivered into your body. That's because the overall concentration in the brain gets to a certain level that begins to cause this runaway effect of central nervous system toxicity. It's just the reactive oxygen is essentially, it is a catalyst for reactions, and those reactions accelerate as a function of how much oxygen is present. In a spacecraft environment, it would be if something fails and the oxygen concentrations start to leak into the cabin at a higher and higher pressure and sort of runaway scenario. This would be sort of a nightmare scenario that would be very unlikely to occur. But I was chewing on this problem and thinking, okay, well, what happens if these two systems fail in this order and you end up with high pressure, high concentration oxygen? And that led me to kind of Googling around, and I came across a study by Dom DiAgostino, who's a ketogenic researcher and a neuroscientist at USF, University of South Florida. And this study took rats, and it showed that when a rat is exposed to the same environment, it tends to go into seizure in, let's say, 15 minutes. I don't have the exact number in front of me. And when that same rat was then fed a ketogenic diet or given ketone esters, so exogenous ketones, it's, for those, I can explain what a ketone is in a second, but essentially they're given a certain macronutrient that crosses the blood-brain barrier. That same rat can live between 5 and 12 times longer before a central nervous system event than if they were on normal normal food.
While staying in the compromised
in the exact same environment.
Okay.
That's correct. So the time to event is extended by 5 to 12x. And this literally blew my mind. I mean, I was sitting there reading this paper over and over and over again, because what it said to me is that the macronutrient content of the rat's diet is giving it what is, in effect, a superpower. It is subject to the oxygen concentrations, just like we are. And yet by eating a different thing, the brain becomes resilient to that environmental scenario that is giving it 5 to 12 times longer life in what would otherwise be a deadly or incapacitating environment. That was repeated multiple times. So there were multiple other studies that showed something similar that Dom and his team had done. And a ketone, for the group listening who might not be familiar, it's basically a fatty acid. Essentially, you can think of it like sort of as a fat molecule that the liver produces when you're in either a very low nutritional environment, so you're not eating a lot, fasting or something similar, or when you consume them externally. In either case, it's a fat molecule that can cross the blood-brain barrier. Most fats cannot do that. And so it can be used for energy by essentially all the cells in your body. It's usually only generated in those two scenarios. And it's a very natural molecule. A lot of people, this is the basis of the ketogenic diet, is that you get into a state where your body's producing those. I had up to that point kind of been a calorie is a calorie absolutist. And this was the moment when I sort of thought to myself, okay, well, this is interesting because essentially a macronutrient can induce physiologic changes. And these changes can be the difference between survival and death in this case. And that was a bit of an extreme example, but it caused me to get very interested in nutrition and in the connection between nutrition and physiology and human performance. So I started going down a rabbit hole, sort of checking in with anyone I could, especially on the medical team that was there at SpaceX, and talking to medical doctors over at NASA to kind of ask them how they're thinking about nutrition as it relates to being in orbit, sort of in space where you do not have access to medical care for years. How are we thinking about this? Is diet a component of that? And this ultimately led me to a really surprising experiment where I tried to measure my own blood sugar and saw that what I assumed to be quite a healthy lifestyle, and again, quite lean, like physically fit at the time, my blood sugar was pretty objectively pre-diabetic. fasting glucose in the morning was never below 113 milligrams per deciliter, which this is, I'm not going to be able to do the millimoles per liter calculation in my head, but essentially like pre-diabetic levels, according to the American Diabetes Association, all my postprandial, post-meal blood sugar readings were kind of off the charts high. And that's when things really kind of accelerated for me. I became obsessed with the space of biomonitoring and how I could intervene.
To play devil's advocate, could those conditions and readings not have been a significant byproduct of the stress, sleep deprivation, training load, et cetera, that you were experiencing at the time as well? And with that in mind, moving out of SpaceX, I can't imagine your day-to-day is particularly stress-free at the moment, but maybe it's a little bit less sleeping under the desk. How have you monitored and adjusted things over time with that in mind, whereby you've been able to track changes in your holistic well-being as well as nutrition? Because obviously when you were faced with that reading, the immediate thinking is to go to the food only, but the overall hormonal stress, everything going on, sleep, all the mechanisms that feed into that make up that reading, don't they? So how have you managed to better understand yourself from a holistic point of view to be able to make the most of that initial round of data to get levels to the point that it is now for the more general population?
Awesome questions. So I've gone through a personal journey of learning that started at that moment when my assumption was my diet must be terrible, to a realization today that everything that happens in all data that is pulled from the body is a compendia. It's a symphony of context and momentary action. So it's the compounding effects of your historical decisions. It's the momentary effects of the stress level you're experiencing. It's the like sort of acute effects of the sleep that you got last night, your training status, your body fat concentration or percentage. All of these things factor in. And, you know, it's surely now the case that I have a more nuanced understanding of how my nutrition factors into that moment in time. Where am I contextually? To kind of rewind to that moment, I was first collecting those glucose numbers. And yeah, I sort of panicked. I was like, what, how could this be possible? If my doctors, first of all, never said anything about blood sugar to me. And secondly, like, you know, this seems impossible based on what I understand about diabetes. It's, or pre-diabetes even. It's for people who are overweight. You know, I don't look like I could even have this, because my understanding was that those two things were directly linked. Ultimately, I read about a continuous glucose monitor. So this was at the time I was using a finger stick, you know, basically pricking my finger obsessively and trying to get a kind of a map of my blood sugar throughout the day. I read about continuous glucose monitors, which are these devices you can wear and it will stream the data continuously. And I was like, oh, that's perfect. I don't have to prick my finger. And I asked my doctor for one. And this was, I kind of explained the situation. It's like, look, I'm, here are the readings I'm getting in the mornings. I'd like to just get one of these and sort of monitor and see what's going on. And if anything I'm doing is specifically, aggravating the situation. And he basically laughed me out of his office. He was just like, this is ridiculous. You're hypochondriac. You know, you don't need this. Not only would you not get one unless you were diabetic, I would only give one to you if you were an uncontrolled diabetic. My pushback immediately to him was, you know, as an engineer, I don't measure systems once they have failed beyond control. I measure them such that they do not fail. My goal is to get ahead of failures. Now, if we know that blood sugar irregularity is a problem, and we know that my blood sugar is showing signs of irregularity, I would like to make sure it does not fully fail before you give me the insight into those levels. That just simply does not play with my sort of psychology here. So you got to give me a better rationale. And he couldn't. And so, you know, I ended up going through kind of this, now I was philosophically angry about the situation. I was like, well, this is now this feels like a property rights situation where like this data is defining my health. And I'm now being blocked access to it by somebody else. This is a gatekeeper scenario. Shouldn't it be the opposite, like financial data, where I'm generating this information and then giving it to the experts that I trust to help me interpret and make actionable decisions? I'm not claiming to be as good as my doctor at interpreting blood sugar data, but isn't this backwards, where I'm asking permission and that permission should actually be mine to grant? So ultimately, I did get a continuous glucose monitor, and it led me to sort of collect data over multiple weeks. I'd started to see fluctuations that related to, you know, on weekends after I had slept super well, my blood sugar was much more controlled eating the exact same foods. I started to see that working out at 10 p.m., which I thought was my de-stressing mode, as I would leave work and I'd go and I'd get an hour long pump in at the gym and then think that was really good. And actually my heart rate is pounding all night long and my blood sugar is elevated all night long because I ate dinner after, you know, after 11:30 p.m. And the next day I'm poorly slept and blood sugar again is much worse. And so I started to be able to use this tool to see relationships between choices I was making and the reaction in my body. And that was kind of the trigger for me, is that this tool became really insightful. And it wasn't that it necessarily changed my blood sugar control right away, but it did give me a level of insight and an awareness that I had never had before. And that was really the founding concept for Levels, is that we are operating in this context every single day. We're making hundreds of decisions. These decisions compound over years and decades into an outcome. And most of these are done blind, completely blind, with no feedback. The feedback is either your doctor diagnoses you with something or the bathroom scale gets beyond a level that you're comfortable with. And my argument to myself and my argument to the world is essentially that we should not be operating without context. If we can measure something continuously, we can theoretically monitor and intervene and control it. But today we aren't even doing the first step of that. So today Levels does not, you know, change blood sugar levels into some, you know, perfect outcome yet. The objective today is to generate awareness between the actions you're taking and the reactions your body's experiencing, and allow people to use that tool however they see fit.
So essentially, if you could summarize the problem that Levels is trying to solve in a sentence, what would it be?
We show you what's healthy, or we show you how food affects your health. The acute reaction to food can often be blamed on the food, but reality is we show you how that food is being processed by your body, and then we show you how to connect the dots between that food and the context that you're operating in. So we pull in information from wearables that have heart rate variability, step count, sleep data. You know, you're wearing a Whoop. There's plenty of wearables out there that pull in this physiologic data. And so we contextualize glucose information against that backdrop of all of the other activities that we're doing, so that we can help you understand how, in a specific moment, a specific type of food is metabolized by your body. And that leads some people to, you know, eliminate certain foods. It leads others to just practice portion control. Still others, actually, the changes they make are exercise and sleep. So they want to keep their diet the same. And so they realize, oh, I should actually sleep more hours, because this completely changes how my breakfast affects me. Or I should take a walk after I eat pizza, you know, rather than eliminating pizza. So it gives you that sense of confidence and the objective data. What I like to call these receipts, digital receipts for micro optimizations. You make a little tweak and you actually get feedback that, oh, that actually did something. Because most of us, you know, many of us who are scientifically minded, we'll just dismiss something that can't be proven. And so this is the evidence for a lot of us.
If you're someone that's looking to get the best out of yourself on a day-to-day basis, then reducing your alcohol intake might be something that's worth considering. And that is where Days Brewing come in. With an enormously refreshing and enormously alcohol-free lager and pale ale, Days provide me with the solution to replace midweek beers with non-alcoholic ones, which has skyrocketed my productivity, cognitive ability, sleep quality, performance, recovery, all these things that are important to me on a day-to-day basis. That's not to say that I'm not having a few alcoholic drinks at the weekend, or once a quarter I will get it very, very wrong with some friends and then regret it for about 3 months before we go again. But during the weekdays have been providing me with the perfect solution to have all the ceremony of a beer without any of the negative effects. Brewed just down the road from me in East Lothian and sold nationwide. If you'd like to grab yourself some Days, then please do head to their website and use the code MODERNMIND20 at checkout to save yourself 20% off. And let me and them know how you get on over social media, as we would love to hear from you.
Thank you for all the detail. It really paints a picture of what this could become, because I think pulling data from other devices that are on you all the time as well is something that really starts to paint a bit of a picture. But there's maybe some drawbacks to that from a psychological point of view that we'll come back to later on. But metabolic fitness, what is it?
Great question. We've defined this as the circumstances under which your body can generate energy without unnecessary byproducts. So the energy that you need to live your life and to perform. So, you know, we are essentially a wet chemistry set. The body is not, we're not, you know, finely tuned metallic machines underneath the skin. We are chemicals contained inside of other chemicals, reacting to other chemicals that are being introduced to the environment. And the way that we generate energy is metabolism. So our cells essentially take the food that we eat and other environmental factors like sunlight, and we break the foods down, process them inside the cellular machinery, and turn those into energy. And that's every cell in the body, from the bone to the skin, to the muscle, to the brain. We talk a lot about these siloed subsets of the body, like mental health and physical health, or mental fitness and physical fitness are increasingly popular terms. But the substrate for your brain to be able to perform, or for your body to be able to perform, is the need for energy. That is the fundamental requirement of the universe, that physics demands that energy be present for work to get done. And so the ultimate foundation of any of those fitnesses, mental or physical, is metabolic fitness. You have to be able to generate that energy. And we know that when metabolic dysfunction sets in, we get a lot of byproducts that are damaging. And that could be hormonal imbalance, where, for example, insulin levels start to skyrocket and you lose the ability to respond to the insulin signal. It could be high levels of inflammation because the accelerated glycation end products, like glucose, is sticking to proteins and fats and creating these sticky balls of broken cellular machinery, start to damage the atherosclerotic, the cardiovascular system, or begin to stick up the brain. And this is kind of one of the reasons that Alzheimer's is being called type 3 diabetes in certain medical circles. Lots of things start to set in that are very consequential and negative when metabolism is starting to break down. And so metabolic fitness is the definition of the metabolic system functioning properly, such that you can live your life, be fit, without any of those unnecessary byproducts.
So I read a study ahead of time that was indicating that in America, as an example, 12% of Americans fit within the terms that have been determined as metabolically healthy. And those are measured across sleep, body composition, and blood markers. So with that in mind, what do CGMs provide that regular blood testing doesn't?
I'm glad you asked that, because what CGM provides is a continuous feedback loop. It does not provide, glucose is interesting, but it is insufficient to tell you your metabolic health. It is a factor, and it's an important one, but it is not the factor. And in fact, what I think is the most powerful is continuous glucose information in the context of frequent blood work. Blood work, pulling blood from the vein, allows you to get a large sample of many of the other molecules that paint in the sort of the high resolution picture of your metabolic health. A lot of these are lipids, you know, the sort of the fat profile of your blood. A lot of them are hormones. A lot of them are inflammatory markers. But continuous glucose information is a really amazing thing, because it's a molecule that is one of the primary, it is the primary fuel source for the modern human. And to be able to see in real time fluctuations, variations, spikes in the system that you're inducing, is a really powerful way to connect the dots between, again, those actions and how you might feel and sort of the consequences, whether weight gain or cognitive cloudiness or sleepiness. And then even further, connect those to those North Star metrics of blood work, right? So if you get a blood panel and then you start using a CGM and sort of observing, let's say I want to lose weight and I want to bring my lipids down, start observing the way that the CGM data correlates with blood sugar spikes, which correlate with insulin elevations, which correlate to fat gain. And you start to intervene and reduce the number of glucose spikes, eating in a more controlled fashion, eating more fiber, maybe taking walks after very rich meals to burn off that glucose in the muscle. And then you test again with blood work later on, and you see that the insulin levels have sort of stabilized, your A1C has come down, and your triglycerides have come down. And that's a very common relationship, right? Carbohydrates can get converted into triglycerides in the liver, and that can sort of drive some cardiovascular risks. So these are the sorts of things that I think are the future, is taking the discrete time points of blood work and correlating them with a really powerful feedback loop that is continuous. You know, there's something magical about being able to sit down, eat a meal, and within 2 hours, you've seen your body respond, and you can kind of have an intuition without needing a PhD for whether or not that meal was a good choice.
It's fascinating. It's fascinating how much information we can currently and will have access to make informed decisions further down the line. And if you compare it to 10 years ago, it's astronomical growth. But with that in mind as well, CGMs at the moment are fairly new in the grand scheme of things in terms of technology. So given that you are thinking a long time ahead at the moment, I would imagine, what do CGMs need to become? How do they need to develop? What are the mechanical parts of you that are getting excited about growth and development? What is the future for CGMs? What is the work that has to happen to make them the best in class for this monitoring? Because they are their life cycle, that they're in an early stage. And as with the life cycle of all technology, I'm sure there's a lot more that can be done to make them more reliable machines and more fit for purpose as time goes on.
It's very exciting. I want to, again, paint the picture a bit, because it can seem a little bit indulgent or biohackery or like sort of a tweak at the tip of the iceberg to be monitoring CGM as someone who, for example, does not already have a diagnosed condition. But to loop it back to the United States, you know, here we have between 88 and 93%, recent study this year says 93% of Americans have at least one marker of metabolic dysfunction. In the UK, it's over 40% of people have either prediabetes or diabetes, but they don't necessarily track the markers, individual markers of metabolic dysfunction as closely. So it's likely much higher.
It's important that, we don't, blood tests are not something we can easily access over here. It's something that everybody, I mean, they've boomed in terms of private access recently. I've never actually had a formal blood test because I've kind of been shopping around online to look at what's where. And I'm also always in and out of big, aggressive, physical outpourings of demand, which means that my blood's a bit of a mess. it's something that I'm doing as much research as I can to sort of know which direction to go and what those frequencies should be, because for years and years I assumed they were only for people with demanding health conditions or for people that were enhanced and wanted to monitor how they were looking at things over a long period of time for health reasons. Whereas now there's so much more research coming out in terms of how they can be used to better monitor individual health. The UK NHS is only looking at them within a very broad range for almost disaster metrics. If you're massively out, then we'll look at things, but you need to be showing signs that make us think you could be massively out before we'll even give you one, which is why the market for the private side of things has increased. So just to give context to the statistic you were giving there, here in the UK, it's not nearly as common as it is in the US.
That's right. Yeah. And that's exactly, I appreciate that additional context, because the assumption should be that the numbers are actually much worse, because to have all of the formal indications that you are pre-diabetic or diabetic is a fairly advanced state to be in. And there are individual markers that tend to lead. And then later you get worse markers that then indicate that yes, dysfunction is now set in at scale. And so 43% of adults in England have at least one long-term condition, and more than half are at increased risk. That's kind of how we can look at the picture. It's probably a bit worse. So the situation is, in the United States, of those between 88 and 93% of people who are experiencing some metabolic dysfunction, the vast majority, according to the Center of Disease Control, is preventable chronic illness, meaning these are the compounding effects of lifestyle decisions. And a lot of this can be attacked from multiple angles. This is not one thing. I certainly don't want to be the person to say that this is entirely food, just eat differently. It's actually a compendium of things. It's the way we're spending more time in stressful states reading the news until late at night. It's scrolling, doom scrolling social media instead of getting outside for a walk. It's eating foods that are ultra processed and that can introduce more energy, specifically more fiber-free, very fast acting, refined sugar into our bloodstreams than, you know, sort of someone 100 years ago would come across in a month. And so it's this combination of factors. And I would wager that of that 93%, a small fraction don't care. The rest do care. They do not want to be unhealthy. They don't want to feel low energy. They don't want to be in a situation where they are depressed, on the fast track to dementia, diabetes, stroke, worse COVID-19 outcomes. Those are all related to diabetes, blood sugar irregularity, metabolic dysfunction. People don't want that, but today they don't have options. It's like, as you just mentioned, even blood work is more difficult where you are than where we are. And yet we don't use blood work in an effective way here in the United States. We don't use data to determine what we do day after day, even though it's those decisions we're making that are leading to an outcome long-term. So the thesis that Levels is operating on is that we call it biological observability. And this is a little bit abstract. I'm going to try to make it like, I'm going to try and ground it here. But in controls theory, controlling any machine, let's just say, you know, cruise control on your car or a remote control car, you know, you're sending a signal. It's creating an input into the system that changes its direction. Just the steering on your car, for example, is a control system. It changes direction. And then you are the control system. You see which way the car changed, and then you adjust the input to bring it back on course. That's what you're doing constantly, thousands and thousands of times. It's the constant feedback loop of observing what happens to the system when you provide an input and then adjusting your inputs. Today, you know, for a control system to work, you need both observability, the ability to see the output of the system, and you need to control the inputs. And those are the observability and the controllability of the system. You need both of those to be able to have control. And I'm sorry, I'm repeating myself a bunch. I just want to try and make that clear, that observability is the ability to measure and controllability is the ability to provide inputs. Today we have inputs. We're making food decisions, sleep decisions, exercise decisions every day, but we are not observing the output, certainly not in a refined way. And in order for us to be able to make targeted controls inputs, meaning I want to control my health, I have to provide targeted inputs in order to achieve some health state. Right now, we are not measuring. We don't have the observability piece. So it is actually impossible for us to target a certain health outcome and hit that with consistency and predictability today. Now, some people are performance experts and they have interoception. They've tried a number of things. They've developed this intuition. But the vast majority of people out there today are operating in complete absence of information. They are literally unsure of why they're gaining weight, why they feel so low energy. They've tried fad diets. They've heard from a cousin that something worked. They don't have anything objective. They do not have observability. And not only that, but there are many very athletic people, very fit people who do not have complete metabolic health. So they have, you may be very physically fit and capable of some extreme endeavors. For someone like, the individual Sami Inkinen, who started Virta Health. I'm not sure if you've heard of him. He sort of placed very high. I think he potentially won his age group at the half Ironman Worlds, and then was diagnosed with prediabetes like a week later. And so there are situations where even those that are optimized are actually off the rails in some direction because they don't have observability. So what Levels is seeking to do is provide that substrate of continuous data that shows how the system is operating. That is the first step to being able to control those outcomes long-term. And to do that, we need to be able to measure a lot more than glucose. Today, we provide the continuous glucose monitor combined with software that can help interpret and provide insights to lead you to potential alternative choices and different timing choices and so forth, combined with blood work. So we do have an in-home blood work product where people, phlebotomists will come, they'll pull blood, run a suite of tests, and you get those results right in the app. And so again, connecting those North Star metrics of health to the CGM data. Long-term, I think the future that we're going to look back on this from is one where we have all of that information continuously being logged in the background, and we have very elegant, intuitive insights that are surfaced for us. So you're going to get off a red-eye flight. You know, you're taking on a tremendous journey in a couple weeks. It sounds like you'll get off that red-eye flight, and it will make a recommendation based on circulating levels of hormone, circulating levels of metabolite, what foods to avoid and what foods to eat, or even maybe a meal timing. If you need to perform, at the gym in 2 hours, recommend eating this food, not that food, based on your historical context. And that's sort of a super future, but to get there, again, the first step is having the awareness, having the observability, being able to measure the human body so that we can make any sort of predictive claims about what is healthy.
I personally like the sound of that because it gives me a lot more control over the things that I hold dear to me. I mean, I'm very in control of trying to manage stresses across the course of the week for training outputs, for cognitive ability, for getting the best out of myself and just general self-development. But that is my individual approach. And we are almost in the echo chamber of those that have come to that realization. Whereas if the current problem is a lack of observability and yo-yoing fad diets, people hearing that their cousin did X, Y, and Z, there's a very big gap to bridge, isn't there, between those that don't yet have that education and access to them getting off a flight and being told, don't eat the bag of Haribo and don't have the diet soda and make sure that you get to bed in an hour. Because the information is available to some degree, at the very least in terms of calorie control, isn't new information now, but it's still not made its way through into federal over your way or government guidelines over our way, which is alarming. I mean, some of the health recommendations coming out of the UK government at the moment are hilarious and just so far off the mark. So the tech, the vision, the growth is all there. But how are you as a business planning for human nature, human tendencies, and our resistance to what's new and a sense of authority as well? Because a device in our pockets telling us what to do is taking us away a little bit from the autonomy that we are also proud to have. And that's a complexity that's very difficult to overcome.
No doubt. Yeah, the first step is, I'm going to work backwards from that list, because I think the paternalistic element there that you described, you know, a device that is sort of nannying you is a real, you know, it's a real concern for a lot of people. And I completely understand. I am actually a person who started this company from a moment in my life where I felt that same sort of protectionism, gatekeeper element, except it was my physician who was responsible for helping me navigate my health. And that person was blocking me from personally understanding what was happening in my body. And that felt like the same degree of issue. The challenge is going to be to surface information in an intuitive and educational way without mandating something, right? It's not, Levels does not have a nutritional dogma. We do not think that everyone has to be ketogenic or carnivore or vegan. We actually seek to rid the world of that sort of tribalism around nutrition decisions, which again, in the context of a lack of observability, is not empirical. It is not evidence-based. Many of these things are actually closer to religions than a nutritional philosophy. And what we need to do in the world is create social conditions where people can, whether directly, wear a sensor that tells them how their body functions, which many of us get tremendous amount of accountability from and confidence in our decisions, or at a secondary effect scale, the nutrition system can be influenced by those people that do. So instead of food companies being able to make any claim they want on the packaging, people are armed with technology that shows them the actual facts about how that food affects them. And then you can sort of begin to undermine nutritional claims that are not founded in reality and begin, I think, to influence through supply and demand effects, different foods being available in the supermarket, for example. So if you have a cohort of people who are wearing CGMs, they tend to make healthier food choices. They tend to avoid ultra processed foods. They eat quite a balanced diet of higher protein, moderate fat, lower sugar. And that will lead, you know, as these things scale, to people selecting those foods, supermarkets biasing towards securing more of those, lowering the prices on them, making them more available. And that makes that food readily available to the person who either can't afford the technology or doesn't want to use it. And so I personally predict that we see social change, social trends change from the bottom up, as opposed to trying to get our politicians to mandate sort of a one size fits all diet, which is where we're going to end up with that paternalistic sort of nanny state feel that no one's going to want to abide by. You know, when you see your body respond to a choice you made, and it's not, there is no software in the loop really telling you, hey, you should avoid that. It's just, this is what's happening in your body in this moment. From personal experience, it doesn't trigger that feeling in me. It's sort of like, oh wow, that's counterintuitive. I'm going to go for a walk. And for other people, I've heard similar things. So it is all about the delivery here. We have to be very cautious not to make this feel like an observation, someone watching you. It very much is you observing your body in conversation with yourself about your goals. And so whether you care or not to avoid, you know, ice cream late night, it's entirely up to you. We aren't going to punish anyone, but I think ultimately having that awareness is really important.
So in an ideal world, would everybody on the planet, subject to means and availability, obviously as a caveat, be wearing a CGM in your mind?
I think that's the direction we're going, in the way that there's no doubt in my mind that a few years from now, or maybe a few decades from now, everyone is going to have connectivity with one another. Today, not everyone has a phone, even though that seems kind of crazy. And yet 10, 15 years ago, no one had a phone, certainly not a mobile device like the ones we have today. So the direction of the technology, I think, will carry us to that point, essentially very close to it, because the tool itself is going to become the substrate for decision-making, and it's going to become the substrate for healthcare. That's just a prediction I feel very confident making. Whether or not it's Levels, it kind of depends on exactly the degree to which we're able to make this actionable and valuable for people. But there's no doubt in my mind that in the future, it will be a choice as opposed to a means test, whether or not you wear a tool that is measuring your health continuously, whether for peace of mind, whether for hitting goals, or whether for specifically reversing a condition, doesn't actually matter. It's that all of those things are essentially just monitoring the system health.
Fascinating. You mentioned earlier there is no nutritional dogma within Levels and the prescriptions it gives, as it's purely observational, essentially, in trying to give you the information to make your next decision more informed. But the general narrative that I've come across is that spikes in blood sugar and glucose and therefore heightened insulin are inherently something to avoid. However, in a higher performance environment from a training point of view, obviously there are ways that glycogen needs to be manipulated around training sessions, around performance, around brain function, around all of the things that go into a more specific example. Whereas I would happily accept the claim that we should try and keep our blood sugar stable and not spiking too aggressively throughout the day if we're sedentary. But I don't think that we should all be sedentary. So what is the narrative? How would you describe Levels' opinion on managing spikes? Because we could fall into the trap here again of people only taking information at surface level and going full circle back to insulin's making you fat, carbs are bad, because people only look at things superficially. And that's, I know deep down that's not what the messaging is, but the risk is that people might fall into the trap of only looking at things at surface level rather than understanding the nuance. So it might be worth almost painting a picture of a desk worker that's an old version of yourself, for example, whereby how could you better manage your existence in a SpaceX environment? And then somebody like myself, who is training up to 30 hours a week at peak, managing 2 to 3 training sessions a day around sort of running businesses and sort of full-time work in and out of things and everything needs to go. So there's high stress, but there is a need to keep glycogen stores pretty well saturated. So a lot to unpack there. I appreciate that. So there's a big, big brain dump from my end. So I think the order of questions is, in reality, what do you perceive the interpretation of blood sugar and spiking to be? And how does that reflect in the two examples that I've just given?
Super important questions, because the nuance here is critical. And right now, Levels is focusing on what we call the middle of the bell curve. So you have people that are very unhealthy on one end of the metabolic health spectrum or the metabolic fitness spectrum. Let's say they have diabetes already or advanced diabetes. Type 2 is kind of what I'm referring to there, where it's sort of a chronic lifestyle related illness. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have sort of the elite athlete who is, again, 2 to 3 training sessions a day, basically in a state of calorie depletion at almost all times. The objective is just to maintain enough nutritional intake that you can get the energy to perform. And then the middle of the bell curve is everyone sort of in between. And most of those people today are increasingly sedentary. Levels is certainly shaping our messaging around that midpoint on the spectrum. And we have not yet reached the point where we have any claims to make about the exercise performance needs of someone who is truly at the elite end of the spectrum, because frankly, I think it's understudied. And as you mentioned, there are environments where you really want, you know, insulin is an adaptive hormone. It's there for a reason. It helps us gain weight. If we didn't have it, we would pass away quite quickly. And so it's not that insulin is to be demonized, but in an environment where most people are sedentary and they're consuming ultra processed foods that are very insulinogenic, and this can be measured in the population, and it currently is, as I mentioned, you know, a single digit percentage of the population here are in an environment where they're metabolically healthy. Most of our messaging is sort of targeted there. Now, what we're doing to work our way out of this is, interestingly, I really appreciate you raising that people may just bias towards the surface level information and sort of replicate what we're saying without that nuance. I think that's actually happening today. And as someone who used to still do spend a lot of time in gyms, but used to sort of replicate what I saw around me, and I would look at the most aspirational person. So I would look at the Tour de France winner, or I would look at the bodybuilder, and I would think what they do is the healthy thing, because look at them. And so what I would do is I would pound hundreds of grams of carbohydrates at my desk. I would drink Gatorades, you know, throughout the day. I would constantly have these ideas of replenishing glycogen and carb loading for the workout, despite the fact that when I zoom out, most of my time was spent at rest in a chair. And it was for that 1 hour performance period that I was sort of fueling. And so I was completely maladapting a training profile for what I actually needed. And so today that is happening, but we don't have that, the nuance of the feedback to tell us, oh, you're overdoing it. Like, yes, glycogen is necessary, or carb loading is necessary for a hard endurance work. But you specifically are already at glycogen capacity. You've been consuming carbohydrates for an entire weekend, and this is your Monday morning workout. And so, you know, unlike the athlete who needs to be truly worried about this stuff in the moment, it can provide a sense of confidence that there is a different path that you're on. And by understanding the goals of the individual, we can do a better job of messaging specifically to them. And that's really where Levels is in our journey, is that we really now it's about understanding again who the individual is, what their objectives are. If it's muscle mass gain, or if it's cutting times down an endurance event, that's very different than someone who needs to lose weight or needs to bring, let's say, their metabolic markers in line. So today, forgive the nuance or the lack of nuance, but I think at some point in the near future, we'll be able to self-select into the kind of user profile that best fits our needs. And I hope to be able to even go a step further and be able to show, based on all of the information we've collected, the decisions for people like you with goals like yours that lead to best outcomes. And that would be really helpful, I think, to be able to kind of follow a track of someone who's in the same sort of footprints, but a little bit further ahead.
Even if it doesn't lead to these other prescriptive outcomes and best practices, it's just much more data to work with, which for people cleverer than I could then process and provide information with. So paralysis by analysis is a phrase that sort of jumps out at me here, because I am a Whoop user and I know a lot of people have tried it and handed it back because they didn't want to outsource their thinking. They didn't want to be told by a device that this is the way that you feel, this is how you respond to things, because there's empirical ways that we can experience those in terms of how we feel, how we respond to things, whether we get snappy that day, whether we wake up feeling a bit groggy, whether we can tell that actually, yeah, I was awake a little bit longer than I was normally last night. My dreams were a bit more intense, got up to go to the bathroom. I have a healthy relationship with these things. So I have all, and MyFitnessPal is a great example as well. MyFitnessPal is an example of how we're into the sort of potential psychological realm of disordered eating here, because you're giving so much data to work with, and it can make somebody quite dogmatic and bordering towards the orthorexic scale in terms of how they process this information. So how do you plan to effectively work against that, rather than just giving another point to work from that takes the power away from the individual to impact change? Because I think what is often lost with the superficiality, like the gym environment you referred to, is people just see that person's wearing a Whoop, I'm going to get Whoop. But they're not actually taking action on the data that it gives you. In the same way, that person's signed up to Levels, I'm going to sign up to Levels. Oh, look, when I eat this, it gives me this big spike. Okay, cool. Same again, off we go. So from a human behavioral point of view, how as a business are you tackling that? Because it's not something that I personally can really quantify, because it's not something I have healthy relationships with these things. I always have, but other people aren't necessarily in that camp. So just asking on their behalf, essentially, what is the game plan there? Because there's going to be more and more tech appearing that I'm sure can feed into the holistic context that Levels is collecting. And all of a sudden, we could have a Whoop device here. We could have a heart rate strap on when we're training. We could have a Garmin on our left wrist. We could then have a CGM in our right tricep. And then you never know, there might be some fancy contact lens coming out soon. So where does it end, and where does the human come into this?
Yeah, you know, I think it all comes down to the way human psychology kind of operates. Is we have to understand why something matters in order to make a real coherent effort or to care in the first place, which is upstream of making an effort. I think Whoop is an amazing tool, and I have used Whoop on and off myself for a long time. I love the company. I love what they're doing. I learned enough about the effects of alcohol to essentially stop drinking nearly altogether. And I don't need to wear a Whoop now to reinforce that. So I actually don't today, but I learned that alcohol has a much more impactful sleep deprivation effect than I had known. And those sorts of things, I think, are the why. I want to sleep well. I want to perform better. And I don't think that some of the proprietary scoring that I was getting from the product were necessarily providing that why, right? It needs to be something that the tool matches the individual's goals, and that it is clear to them how that relationship is formed. One thing that I think is different about CGM and about Levels is that I would never say that every person has to wear a CGM for the rest of their lives. that's going to be an individual choice. My objective is to provide a tool that will give you truly personalized biological information about how your body responds to the choices you are making, and to provide a layer of insight that you can take or leave up to you that will help you modify those decisions if you see fit, and observe how they change. I think it's going to be the case that certain people will want to wear levels forever because they make changes. And we've had examples of people losing 80 pounds by simply eating. That's like on the order of 38 kilograms, simply eating in a controlled blood sugar way. So eating a food, seeing that it spikes off the charts, changing that portion size or that the ingredients, seeing that it is nice and controlled, and just doing that. There was no dogma involved, just eating that way, losing, you know, a dramatic amount of weight. And that person is going to use this tool for the rest of their lives as an accountability mechanism. They understand the why. This relates to them maintaining a dietary philosophy that helps them maintain weight loss. Other people who are already fairly healthy and want to just confirm that their choices are sort of not actively harming something about their metabolic function may only check in. They may try it for a month and say, that was really insightful. I'm glad I did it. I don't have anything really to change. Everything's pretty good. And I'm going to kind of go back to my old light way of living. That is absolutely inside of the levels philosophy. And it's why we have a membership model where we don't actually force contracts or long-term obligations on people. We want you to try the tool if it works really nicely. And if you understand the why, how it fits with your goals, you'll probably continue wearing one. But it's not a mandate. And I think that's how this, you know, this industry has to be built, is around the user, around the problem they're solving, around actionability. Otherwise, you know, we're never going to force people to wear this, and it certainly won't have staying power if it doesn't solve a problem for people. So that's how I would think about it, is it's a sort of a product solution approach where if it has value, people will want it. And fundamentally, I don't intend to get the government to mandate people to use this. You know, that would be a nightmare scenario for me as an individual and how I think about the world. I want this to be something that is people are obsessive users because it has changed their lives for the better. And I hope to see a future where, like I said, that is done so effectively that it's almost a no-brainer for everyone to want to have this information.
The way I see it is it's another consolidation calibration point for us to gather information about ourselves to make more informed decisions. But the thread of DNA that runs through that is us having the agency to make those decisions, as it is with Whoop. Because again, I got a lot of people asking me, oh, should I go Whoop or Garmin? I'm like, well, they're completely different things. One is an activity tracker, one is a lifestyle tracker, and they provide you with different information. And they are better at one thing than they are the other, and there's no point in having a lifestyle tracker if you're not taking note of the data in its entirety and understanding why it is the way that it is, which is why for some people, as you said, 6 months of usage might be all they need to then know, right, these are the habits that are good for me. And then maybe I'll revisit it in 10 years when I feel a little bit more decrepit and old. In the same way that Levels could provide a solution to help give people a better understanding of the nutritional decisions they make on a day-to-day basis, but also understand the mechanisms of why they're reacting to things the way that they do. Because I assume, with the example you gave there, the 38, very quick maths, you can tell you're an engineering background there on the pounds to kilogram conversion. The example there, were those people... not ignorance, the wrong word, but were they coming in quite limited in terms of their understanding of the principles of nutrition ahead of time? So did they understand that by monitoring their portion control, monitoring their blood sugar, the mechanism at play was essentially thermogenesis and essentially energy balancing? But the same way that they got there is the same way that by removing a macronutrient with keto, you in effect eat less. However, the exclusion of an entire food group with keto is where it might then have a negative effect on you, your individual health, how you respond to things and fueling. But then again, the other end of the spectrum, if it fits your macros, means that you can have a Twinkie pre-workout and feel great about yourself, which is probably the wrong way to approach things. So am I right in assuming that essentially the principle that runs through all of this is based on the sort of the consistent nutritional understanding in the industry at this point, underpinned by giving the user the information they need to understand how they as an individual respond to the things that they are consuming, so that they can better manage the acute responses that they have internally to those foods on a day-to-day basis? Is that essentially the sort of the top line summary that we've circled to.
Yeah, that's essentially it. I mean, this is a tool to provide metabolic awareness. It's giving you insight into how your body is respond, the actions you're taking, the reactions your body's experiencing. And again, you know, when I do a high intensity interval workout in the morning, my cortisol is already elevating. This is a natural phenomenon called the dawn effect, which I first observed with my blood sugar elevating in the morning without eating anything. If I then go into a hard workout, my blood sugar can exceed 200 milligrams per deciliter, so over 10 millimoles. And that would be, if it was a Twinkie that caused that, that would be something I would avoid forever. I don't need to cause that. And there's plenty of reasons I can provide for why you don't want your blood sugar that high. The way that we manage diabetes is one, but the physiologic effects of an intense workout versus a Twinkie are fundamentally different. Exogenous sugar breaking down in the bloodstream, circulating, glycating tissues, and then having to be pulled out of the bloodstream by insulin to be stored as fat as I sit, you know, on the bus or on the couch is very different than my muscles essentially breaking down glycogen in real time, metabolizing them in the muscle fiber to be used for energy, the liver producing additional glucose from gluconeogenesis to continue to fuel that process in a fight or flight way to make sure I have the energy to perform. And for 48 hours afterwards, it is demonstrated and documented that I am more insulin sensitive than I was before that exercise. Those are not comparable. And so it's really important for us to be able to draw a distinction between these different events and how they're affecting the body. But certainly, you know, when I say we're not dogmatic, I do believe that we are causing damage to the body from overconsumption of certain foods. And certain foods, hyperpalatable, ultra-processed, with no fiber involved, these foods are just simply not great choices to base our nutritional decisions on. And it's really important for people to see that evidence. You know, I'm somebody who used to eat candy for dinner. I mean, I would literally eat candy until fullness and had no body fat issues. So why bother? Why does it concern me? Well, when I saw that my blood sugar levels, now, you know, it's not like I did that every day, but I would do it. When I saw that my blood sugar levels were kind of going pre-diabetic, if not into the diabetic range, after eating brown rice pasta and lean chicken and broccoli, my modification was I adjusted the portions to have more protein, less of that carbohydrate, and more of the vegetables and fiber. And now I can eat the same ingredients. None of these are to be vilified, but the way my body responds to them was something that I wanted to tune because I wanted to try to maintain a glucose control that was more closely correlated with long-term better health outcomes. You can look at the quartiles of blood sugar elevations after meals and fasting morning glucose, and they're very closely related to outcomes. And so that's the information we want to surface, is show people how their bodies specifically are metabolizing. You know, we don't get into the calories game because ultimately tracking calories is something that only certain people have the patience to do. But ultimately what we want to show you is that how that meal on that plate affects you, and then give you some insights to how to maybe tweak them if you feel that is necessary.
Fascinating. Lots to unpack, and
yeah,
there's lots happening, isn't there? So do you want to just give us a very brief rundown of what 2023 looks like for Levels and where people can find out more information?
Absolutely. Yeah. So definitely recommend checking out our blog at levelshealth.com/blog. This year we are expanding. We're building this product very quickly and trying to continue, again, as I mentioned, making this actionable and educational. And so the product features are kind of rolling out quickly. We are taking on the very earliest stages of building our presence overseas, moving out of the US into the UK. We're building a wait list right now because we aren't yet readily available in the UK. I believe we have a link set up, levels.link/modernmind, for the listener here if you are interested in joining that wait list. But again, the blog is the source of information for what we're doing. Kind of we dive into the physiology and background and also introduce some of the concepts that we're building towards. And then I recommend following us on Twitter and Instagram at Levels. And yeah, looking forward to kind of hearing any feedback that people have after listening to this. I always love having some dialogue, and we have a number of channels. The DMs on those platforms are really, they're open, and would love to communicate about it.
Fantastic. Well, no, thank you very much for your time. Really enjoyed unpacking what is quite a new phenomenon, but one that I think is going to be integral to the future of the health and fitness industry. And I see no better candidate to assess and develop the technology than somebody who has a very clearly mechanical mind, which is something I couldn't quite comprehend, but have learned a lot from today. So thank you very much, and have a good afternoon, is it, with you?
That's right. Yes. Yeah. Cool. Well, Fergus, it's been awesome to talk to you.
Yeah, no, appreciate it. You're going to give me some LA recommendations, and we are going to say goodbye. Thanks, everyone. And there we have it, another episode of The Modern Mind complete. And thank you to those of you that are still here. massively appreciated. Just a quick reminder to do all of the podcasty stuff. Follow, subscribe, share with a friend. Thank you very much. Please do engage with the show sponsors and make sure to sign up to the Modern Mind emailing list through the show notes down below. Thank you very much. Hope there were some things that you took away from that, and I will see you next time.